Judiciability Empowerment Now, Season 3. I'm your host, Keith Murphy DeGincini. Today I'm talking to Andrew Markham, the Academic Director of the Disability Studies Program at the City University of New York School of Professional Studies. Andrew, welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you so much, Keith. I'm really glad to be here.
So last season, I interviewed outgoing academic director and co-founder of the program, Dr. Marriott Bates. Tell me how it was like getting her job and stepping into the role left by an academic titan of the industry.
Well, you're certainly right that I had some really big shoes to fill. But I mean, Marriott is a great mentor and a wonderful friend and just a really wonderful person. And she shares a lot of the values of disability studies and the disability community in terms of mentorship and supporting one another and interdependency and understanding that, you know, each of us has a shared passion for keeping this program going and keeping it strong. So I've relied on her quite a bit over the last year for advice and support. She's always been there for me. So that part was easy. The challenging part, of course, is just being new to the job, being new to New York City, and you know, it's been a challenge that has been enjoyable at times and not so enjoyable at other times, but it's always been rewarding in terms of like personal professional growth. Just having the opportunity to take a program like this one, which is in a very strong position, a leading program in the country, and find creative ways to continue to support and expand it, offering new courses, bringing in a new and more diverse faculty, maintaining our full-time faculty, and hopefully restarting our Journal of Teaching Disability Studies and getting our fourth edition out sometime early next year. These are some of the things I've been excited about. And I know that Marriott's been excited with me, and she's been supportive in terms of providing advice and insights. So it's been great. I mean, you say she's definitely a titan, but she's a very supportive and nice and lovely person to work with. So in that sense, it was easy.
She's also very humble. When I interviewed her last season, I learned so much about her that I didn't know and would have no idea.
She's had a fascinating life and
absolutely
made some really interesting contributions to disability studies.
I told her at the end of the interview, I thought I knew you well, but given everything you've told me in this interview, I feel like I've learned so much more about you than I could possibly dream up. I'm a creative writer by trade, and the life she's lived is just remarkable. So tell me, how did you first come in to the Disability Studies program.
So I started teaching for the program in 2016, and that occurred because at that time I was a postdoctoral research fellow at the Institute for at the oh it was a long title I was a postdoc research fellow at the University at Buffalo in the Disability Studies program there, and I was also working with the Institute for Inclusive Design and Environmental Access at that time in the Disability History Museum in Buffalo. And I one of my duties as a fellow at that time was to organize a disability studies conference to talk about important issues facing people with disabilities, and especially around the issue of design and environmental access. One of the people attending at the conference was a faculty member at the time called April Coughlin, and I think she went on to SUNY New Paltz, but she was like, she I presented at the conference, and she was like, "Hey, my friend Mariette Bates is looking for people to teach disability studies courses. You maybe should really reach out to her, you know, if you need some extra money or you want some teaching." And I was like, "Of course, you know, because I definitely was interested in that." So I reached out, and then I started teaching courses, and then, you know, several years later, the opportunity to move up came my way, and it was, you know, it was great. It's thrilling. It's something I'm really I feel very grateful to be in this position, to have the opportunity. And I think that Mariette, while I was teaching for Mariette, I was also helping to develop a nonprofit in Buffalo called the Center for Self-Advocacy. And so I know probably from your interview with Mariette, you know that she was also in the nonprofit sector, advocating for people with disabilities and creating support there. So we shared that in common, which I think is one of the things that helped lead to this opportunity for me, was the idea that that we shared in common a commitment not just to academics, but also to community praxis and supporting the community and doing scholarship and supporting academics that is community driven and socially relevant and actually makes a practical difference in people's lives.
So you're coming up on your first year in this job. Is that correct?
Yep, that's right. Yeah.
So how have, I know you, we both respect and revere Mariette Bates, Dr. Mariette Bates Hartley. How have you branched out and made the program your own, or not your own, but expanded the reach of the program? I remember one thing she tried to do, but couldn't get done for reasons beyond her, is to start a PhD program in disability studies. Is that on the docket for a few years down the line, or what are some of your goals as the new academic director of this program?
I think to begin with, we're in a very strong we have a very strong foundation. So I want to build on that foundation, and I think that I think that a PhD program would be fantastic at some point in the future. And I think the work that Mariette has done already positions us to move in that direction. But there are other things I think that we want to have in place to help us get there, and they include expanding course offerings. So we have courses, for example, in disability and religion, and disability in music and the arts, and disability in the history of eugenics. These are all courses that students are interested in taking, and we have them in our program on the books, but we haven't been able to offer them to students because we need faculty to teach, and we need courses to be developed and actually created with syllabi and all that stuff. So that's one thing we want to do, so that if we get to the point where we have a PhD program, we've got a more robust course offering to draw on. Another thing we want to do is to increase the diversity of our faculty, and bring in those who are innovators in disability studies and developing new and cutting-edge perspectives in disability studies, and that will connect with our students. So, as you know, we have a world-class group of adjuncts and professors that teach for us, many of whom have been leaders in areas like disability and law and disability advocacy. So that is something we want to retain and maintain, but we also want to expand on that to open up new horizons in disability studies, including in the area of the arts, as well as in our Master of Science program, where we could have some additional courses there, expand there. And then I think that would really, I would hope, would put us in line to stay on track to one day become a program that could offer a PhD. So I think Mariette and I are on the same page with regards to that. But we also both recognize that there are institutional constraints and that these things take time. So even as you set out your own goals, you know, you're always still standing on the shoulders of giants, and you need to build on what's been done and take advantage of the strengths that you have as a program to move forward. And I hope that's what I'm doing.
So you're also a distinguished lecturer. Please tell me more about that angle, and are you still doing that in your new position?
Yes, I'm happy to report that I do get to teach still in my new position, and part of my responsibility is to teach. And I'm really glad about that, because that's really what motivated me to be in academia in the first place. I was the first in my family to graduate from college. You know, I grew up with cerebral palsy and multiple disabilities in it. And, you know,
Wait,
as a,
wait, wait, hold on. Hold on, sorry. Did you just say that you grew up with cerebral palsy?
Yes. Yeah, I mean, obviously, that's one of the things that drew me to disability studies. But my first inkling to be in the arena of teaching college was really about how being exposed to a college education was transformative for me, and I wanted to bring that to other people. And disability studies became a way for me to do that in a way that was meaningful for me personally, but also that I think other people could relate to, because it came from a place that was real and honest.
Well, sorry to interrupt. I didn't know that. I don't know why I would know that, but it's like I have cerebral palsy, so I'm always really hyped up when I meet someone who has cerebral palsy, and to know that it's led you into teaching and finally at your new job, it's just empowering.
Yes, I'm, like I say, I feel really lucky to be in this position, but I'm also aware of like all the work and sacrifices that not only I've made, but people before me made to make it possible, to even have a field called disability studies, where we talk about disability from a social, cultural, and political perspective. That's like decades and decades of hard work and sacrifice on the part of so many different people from all different sectors of society and the academy to make that a reality, to be in a position to carry that on and build on it is like really, it's incredible, and I'm really glad about it. But I also feel like, I recognize that I'm here for a reason. It didn't happen overnight or accidentally. And I hope that other people can be encouraged and inspired by that. But at the same time, I think that people should be encouraged and inspired, just because just for who they are. And I reject the idea that we have to be judged by what somebody else considers to be an unimportant accomplishment.
Oh, yes, I completely agree. And that's why I used the word empowering instead of inspiring.
Yeah. Well,
We.
I know
Yeah.
you've heard of this critique of inspiration in disability studies, that this notion of inspirational narratives can cover up systemic injustices and practices, and just can cover up how difficult it is to get somewhere and try to sort of whitewash everything and not really be helpful or instructive in terms of how can we help people be successful and really do what they want to do and be themselves and not pretend like everything is fine.
Yeah, I mean it. Like, you were one of my last teachers in the program. I took a course with you during my final semester, textual analysis, which I should have done a years prior when I was involved in a medical fellowship program. But I would have outed myself with my cerebral palsy because it was academically relevant. It's just another facet of you and getting to know you and learning how your lifelong disability has shaped who you are, how you've perceived injustice, and it's gotten you to this point in your life. And so I'm just very touched that I was able to find out something so not per not I don't want to say personal, even though it is. It adds a very important facet to the work that you do. And I found that very encouraging that someone with a disability can climb the ranks and will want to climb the ranks of academia to get to the point where you are now.
Well, thank you. Thank you.
Yeah.
And, I just want to say, there are professors and people in my past as a graduate student and even as a college student that I think back on and I feel the same way about them and find that when I think about them and how they supported me, that's one of the things that kept me going over years and years of like failure and frustration and disappointment and not getting the job and wondering, I mean, by the time I took this position, I wondered if I was going to have a career in academia because I'd been on the job market for several years. And I was working, of course, I was working in the nonprofit sector and doing disability advocacy, and I was using my academic skills, but, you know, I was kind of, I wondered if I was going to have a chance to be in academia or not, you know? So.
And so what inspired or motivated you to pursue a career in academia? And when did that passion start?
Oh, yeah, like I was saying earlier, I was the first in my family to go to college. So it was like opening up the world to me to think about, you know, philosophy and poetry and critically thinking and thinking about history and culture and why things are the way they are. Why are things the way that they are? And so that was the beginning of it for me was just like looking at the college professors I had and how they opened up the world to me. And I thought, I would like to do that for other people. That seems like a fun thing to do. I think that I could do it well because I had good communication and good writing skills. And so that was the start of it. And then, you know, when I started studying American history and culture as my area of expertise, working on my master's degree and then my PhD, I felt like disability was a relatively underrepresented area of study and inquiry when it came to American history and American culture. And so I thought, well, this is an area where I can contribute and do something new and maybe have an opportunity to explain disability in ways that people haven't, that it hasn't been explained before, or, you know, that finding ways to explain it to people that would be away from the model of that it's a deficit, it's something to be cured, it's something that we need to eradicate. So I felt I could make a contribution there. And that's the long and the short of it. And I had, yeah, yeah, go ahead. No, so then I, you know, I started to look into like disability history and how the history of disability gets created in the United States. And that's when I started to understand more about the history of the disability rights movement and disability advocacy and concepts like self-advocacy and ableism, and then how ableism is connected to other forms of oppression such as racism, gender discrimination, how we value certain bodies and certain people and not others, you know, and So then I met disability historians and people with disabilities who were advocates. And I did a research fellowship at the Smithsonian Institution, at the National History, at the National Museum of American History, where I got, I looked at disability artifacts from the history of the US and that kind of thing. And so then, of course, that just drew me in deeper to the world of disability studies. So that's how I went from broadly looking at the history of the US and a culture to more specifically zeroing in on disability.
So you've gotten your academic sea legs, as it were, in regards to this new position that you have. And you're at the top of your field, with a very important program. Could you talk more about some of the challenges and positives that come with running a program such as this, that people may not appreciate? Unless they were doing it themselves.
Well, I'm just thinking the first thing that comes to mind is that one thing that continues to be a challenge is breaking through the medical model of disability. And I mean that in several different ways. When you talk to people about disability studies, most of them, even in academia, even in the humanities, or even in the interdisciplinary fields, they still have a difficult time understanding what that means. And they still tend to think of it and frame it in terms of a biomedical model, right? So they're thinking about providing support for people with disabilities, providing interventions for people with disabilities, building programs for people with disabilities. Now, don't misunderstand, all those things are very important and they're important to disability studies. But what disability studies wants to do is help us to understand that people with disabilities actually don't have special needs. We have the same needs as everybody else. And what we need is not a special program, but a rethinking of our society to be designed and supported in a way that makes things inclusive and accessible to people so that, we're not defining people by what they can't do, but we're able to value them for what they can do and create spaces and environments where they can be supported. And that's a different way of thinking about disability than thinking about it as just something that we need to manage, or something that we need to take care of, or something that we need to cure, or something that we need to adapt to the existing world. We should be thinking about how do we have a society that's accessible and flexible and meaningfully inclusive for all people, instead of thinking about what do we do about disability? How do we solve the problem of disability? I think disability is an asset, disability is a strength, disability is an aspect of human diversity. It's also a challenge, and it's also painful, and it's also messy, and it's also embodied and difficult. But we still have to see it as an aspect of diversity rather than an aspect of disease or deficit or something that we have to run away from.
So when I started the program, it was a hybrid program, I believe. in 2014. And then I did online for several years, and then I came back in 19, the last semester they were doing in-person classes, because I figured that, well, I started in-person, I should finish it in-person. And I'm very glad I was able to do that. Now, and that's how we met. And so now you guys, the program is fully online. To my knowledge, talk more about the strengths and challenges of doing a fully online program versus a hybrid, and is there any clamoring from students of, we would like a hybrid program again, or is it we're really comfortable with the online teaching aspect, and we're able to reach so many more people because of that?
Yeah, I think on the whole, and I don't want to make a totalizing statement, but I think on the whole, it's the latter. That I think we're very lucky as a program that even when we had in-person courses, we were on the cutting edge of online learning as a school at CUNY. And we were doing a lot of online learning already because of, I think, the obvious benefits, which were we can reach people wherever they're at. We can provide flexibility and accommodation and accessibility in the online space in ways that we can't always do in person. And that includes opportunities for, you know, applying universal design and accessibility features, which is something we're still working on. It's always a work in progress, but the online environment gives you a lot of flexibility to reach people that you may not be able to reach, including people with disabilities. You also get access to an entire world, essentially, certainly an entire country of minds and talent and faculty. We have faculty, you know, from all across the country, from coast to coast, and we're able to do that because of the online structure. And we have students from all over the world too, and a very diverse group of students, and online helps in that regard too. At the same time, you know, there's always a few students who would prefer or who would like to do in person, and there are some advantages to that, of course. Like, when I think about the years that I taught in person, one of the things that I enjoy the most about it was being able to have an instant connection with students, being able to be in a classroom, look a student straight in the face and talk to them, learn from them, and very quickly assess who are they, what are some of their needs, how can I support them. It's much more difficult to do that in the online environment. It's harder to get to know your students. But there's ways to do it, and there's creative things that you can do to make it work. And you can really involve your students in the learning process by having them help you create course content and allowing them flexibility in expressing what they've learned through multiple means, whether it's creating a podcast or sharing a short video or doing an annotated bibliography, whatever it is, you know, letting students know that they can bring their own insights, perspective, and knowledge to the course. And I'm not going to ask them to just listen to the lecture and regurgitate it. So, you know, I think the thing I miss most about teaching in person is that direct connection and being able to collaborate with students in real time, instantly, like one-on-one in person. That can't be replicated online, but at the same time, online still offers a lot of things that can't be done in person. So, you know, I hope that depending on how things evolve, who knows, we may indeed find ourselves able to do hybrid again. But for now, I think our enrollment is up. You know, we're up, I think, 20-25% maybe over the last year. The general feedback is it's great to have this program available to me. I'm a working adult. I'm passionate about disabilities. I need the flexibility that online asynchronous offers. So I think we're well positioned, and we were lucky that during the horrible, catastrophic pandemic, we did have the online infrastructure and capability, and we were able to keep things going rather smoothly. In fact, we wound up becoming, as a program, we wound up becoming a place where other CUNY schools came to learn about online at a time when it was urgent to learn about online. So I think that's something we can be proud of and build on.
So you mentioned enrollment is up, if you don't mind me asking. What is the general number now, and what was it before the pandemic? And you talked a little bit about it before, but more in depth, what do you attribute the rise to of the program?
I mean, I think that, you know, with the pandemic, certainly people were looking for online options, and they were looking for options, and we were positioned to offer them an online education. A lot of schools and a lot of programs were scrambling and kind of panicked because they had no experience teaching students online. They had no idea what to do in an online setting or how to do it. And, you know, we didn't have that problem. So, I mean, I think that that was part of it, that worked to our advantage. And I think, I don't know, this is maybe a little bit metaphysical, but I think that the difficulties of the pandemic drew people's attention to the importance of some of what disability studies is about, which is about how do we build a society where quality of life and well-being and support systems and a sense of social justice and equality of opportunity and access can be nurtured and supported. I think, you know, the challenges that we faced over the last several years underscore the need for employers, for example, to be flexible in the workplace, to give people the option to work remotely. People with disabilities have been saying that for decades and decades before the pandemic. And then the pandemic occurs, and all of a sudden people without disabilities are rethinking their ableist assumptions about what remote work means, what it means to work from home, what it means to have greater flexibility in terms of when and how you work. I mean, that's just one example of how I think disability studies became more relevant in the pandemic. And that was part of why, in addition to having an infrastructure that could provide what people needed, we also had a curriculum that was relevant and meaningful to people in ways they hadn't thought about. You know, you go to the hospital and the gaps in our healthcare system become really apparent. And then you start thinking about the critiques that people with disabilities have issued over the decades of our social support system and the ways that it punishes people who have access or functional needs and doesn't adequately meet our needs as a society. Like, those things become more relevant in a crisis like that. And I think that encourages people to seek out knowledge and solutions, and hopefully that's what our program offers.
I know that right at the lab, probably a bit before, right at I graduated, a lot of former students were being hired to teach, to come back as teachers. Is that still an aspect of the program? You mentioned earlier about diversitizing the staff and subjects taught. Is that still a part of the teaching angle and factory angle that was shepherded by your predecessor?
Yeah, I think that I don't think that Mariette would disagree. And we part of what we want to do is expand the pool, expand the world of disability studies, expand the perspectives on it. So I really do think we want to focus on bringing people who weren't necessarily part of the program in, simply so that we can benefit from the perspective of other scholars in other fields who are also invested in disability studies just as much as we are. You know, our program produces talented people and people who are knowledgeable about the subject. And so it makes sense in some regards that some of those people will come back and teach for us. But at the same time, we recognize that if we want to have a truly diverse and dynamic program, we do need to reach out further afield and recruit people who are in different fields and invested in disability studies in different ways. And I think actually, I mean, if you look at our faculty overall, yes, we have some alumni who've taught for us over the years, but we still have an enormously broad group of folks in the disability world doing different things. We just need to continue to focus on that and not we don't want to create a situation where intellectually we become stagnant, or we become insular, or we're only listening to each other's perspectives and repeating the same perspectives over and over. So, do you know what I mean? It's important to bring in other perspectives. That doesn't mean that you don't find ways to support your alumni and support their work. It just means that sometimes you need to look beyond that pool.
So talk a bit about diversitizing the course offerings and what that process is like, because you mentioned a lot of new courses that just need syllabi and teachers, and they're all courses I'm interested in, so I'm really chomping at the bit of trying to figure out a way to re-sign up to take those courses. So talk more about not only diversitizing the teaching, but diversitizing the course offerings of the program.
Yeah, I think there's a couple of different components. Part of having a diverse staff is going to help you develop diverse courses, because they're going to bring ideas and perspectives that you never thought about and want to develop courses that you never thought about. But the other part of it, frankly, Keith, is just taking the courses that we already had, the ideas that we already had, and figuring out how we make them into a reality. And that becomes complicated because of all the different institutional dynamics. You know, do we have the money to hire another person? Can we, are we able to find someone who really fits into this? And if we offer this course this spring, will we have enough students enrolled to be able for the course to go off? Will this elective take students away from another elective that they need to complete? So you're trying to think about not only what do students want and what do they need, but how can you arrange a course, a set of courses and curricula that are going to help them matriculate through their degree program in an efficient manner, in an effective manner, give them real learning outcomes that are going to help them professionally and personally. I mean, you asked me earlier, what are the challenges of this job after a year? And this is the biggest one, is really trying to figure out how you meet students' needs when those needs are quite diverse and everything. These things are pretty complicated, you know. We have to create a course of study that we can prove is effective and that we know is effective. And, you know, we have to prove that, but we also have to do what support our students and what they want to do. So we need to listen to them and, you know, what courses is it that they need? You know, we know that our grant writing course has been a huge hit, and students say, like, we want more of this. We want more grant writing courses and this kind of practical experience that's going to help us in our disability advocacy work and in our nonprofit work. And so on. So, in addition, and so in terms of creating a diversity of curriculum, that comes with a diversity of faculty and perspectives, but it also comes with thinking creatively about how you make courses happen, even when you have limited resources and constraints, that you probably most people don't think about unless you're trying to direct an academic program.
So what were, let's talk about when you got offered the job and what were some things that may have surprised you. I know that's a assumption, but I mean, stepping into this role, even as a academic, must have been even a little bit overwhelming. And so how did you adapt to your new position coming from just being a lecturer, a teacher?
I mean, I think one of the things that really helped was the fact that I had spent a nearly a decade doing nonprofit work, because a lot of this job is administrative and it is supervisory, and it's also about thinking creatively to solve problems. You have to think creatively every day to solve problems. So going back to the previous question about, you know, expanding course offerings, it's a challenge to do that for a number of reasons. You have to think about what does that mean for your curriculum that you've already agreed upon with the state of New York? Is that going to be the course that students need? What resources do you need to staff that course? All those. So problem solving, thinking critically, working collaboratively with other people, because as a program director, you have to do things like, make sure your enrollment stays up, and that means working with the admissions department, and reviewing applications for admissions in a timely way, and all those different kinds of components. So it was overwhelming, undoubtedly. I think I told you last year when you asked me if I wanted to do this, I was like, well, I'm not ready to do an interview with you, Keith, because right now this is all a bit overwhelming. But it was a huge help to have nonprofit experience. And I think I mentioned at the beginning of our talk what a huge help Mariette was as well. Always available, always there for me when I had questions, when I had challenges, when I was dealing with some strange, unexpected thing. So those were two things I would say that were the biggest help in terms of dealing with the challenges of just starting in a new position.
And so if there are any aspiring self-advocates, what listening to this episode, and you came from a self-advocacy background, a non-profit background, and academia background, what would be some action steps that you would give them as they begin their journey as professional self-advocates?
I guess I think for me, it's really acknowledging what does that mean for me to be a self-advocate, and what is it that I, why do I want to do this, right? And just coming to terms with who you are. I mean, that sounds like a cliched and simple thing, but the reality is that in a world where people with disabilities are often spoken to, spoken about, spoken for, but are not usually provided the space to speak for ourselves, figuring out who you are and what your passions are and what you want to do is like oftentimes the biggest hurdle. It's the biggest step. So, I mean, self-advocacy is a big arena. What are you advocating for? Why? What is this? What is the driving passion that you have? You know, you need to know what that is. And then I think you need to also have a grasp on what ableism is and how to deal with it in an effective way that doesn't get you hung up. What do I mean by that? I mean that you're going to encounter discrimination and ableism in your day to day, and you have to be prepared for that. And sometimes you have to just let it, you know, you have to pick your battles, but you have to, don't try to hide that away or stuff it away. Like, you need to practice what is it, that poem by Laura Hershey, "You Get Proud by Practicing"? She has this poem called, have you heard of that poem? "You Get Proud by Practicing." Laura Hershey, a disabled woman, I think she identified as a lesbian. She was an activist in Denver for many years. And she has this poem called "You Get Proud by Practicing." And she gives all these beautiful examples of people embracing their disability identity, fighting for a more accessible and just world, and what that means. And sometimes it means really small things, like just being proud of yourself. You know, she writes in there that you don't need a big car or a fancy car or a boyfriend or a girlfriend to be proud. You don't need to have somebody else's standard of success to be a successful self-advocate. You can just be yourself and be proud of yourself. And you do that by practicing, by not hiding away from who you are, by not staying silent when you face discrimination or there's a misunderstanding. You use your understanding and your knowledge to broaden people's perspective so that other people in your position don't have to do as much work next time. And everybody's doing that work so that hopefully we're moving things forward.
To answer your question, no, I didn't know about that poem or that activist. So, wrapping up, and I want to thank you so much for your time and your professional and personal candor and the ability to be vulnerable during this talk. I would like to hope that both advocates with disabilities and those who have yet to discover their own disabilities listen to this podcast. And I wouldn't assume that they would get or take away things the same way. And so as my guests and everything we've talked about over this interview, what do you hope that advocates with disabilities take away from listening to this episode? And what do you hope that those who have yet to discover their own disabilities take away from this episode?
Oh, well, thank you for asking that question. You know, it's really, I think it's just really one of the things that I hear myself saying repeatedly as we've been talking is that one of the challenges that I find is that the social model of disability is still something radical and it's still something new for so many people in so many arenas in life, even for people with disabilities themselves who come to the program and are blown away by the different ways of thinking about disability and the importance of thinking differently about disability. And so I guess to concretize that more, make it clearer, how we think about disability shapes how we respond to disability. So if we continue along the lines of thinking that disability is problematic, that it's something to be avoided, that it's only something to be cured, that it's something to be ashamed of, that it's something to euphemize when we talk about rather than be direct about. As long as those kinds of things and ableist attributes about what constitutes hard work or what constitutes beauty or what constitutes value, as long as we continue to have ableist structures of thinking and ways of thinking about disability that are detrimental in terms of how we respond, we're not going to have real change. So that's the reason why it's so important for people who work in the care and support fields, for people who work in the healthcare arenas, for people who work in the nonprofit sector, for people who are designers and urban planners and people who work in civil and civic government, for people who work in the disability service system. That's why it's so important for them to understand the social model and so important to talk about disability as a social, cultural, historical, political formation and not just as a biomedical formation. And that's why it matters. And I hope that advocates who are listening, or people who haven't, as you said, discovered their disability, or people who are confused about their disability or upset about, or, you know, just have negative feelings about it, I hope what they take away is like, there's a way to look at disability that isn't negative, that people with disabilities have a history and we have our own perspectives and we have our own knowledge, but we also can look at disability as something that doesn't have to be viewed as a negative. Any more than any other human difference needs to be viewed as a negative. And I hope that we, as people with disabilities, we have specific insights and knowledge to help the world become a more inclusive space. Like we can contribute to not just designing a more inclusive world, but to creating a more inclusive world in terms of how we think about difference and diversity and how we structure our work environments and our physical, all those things. Like, we have a lot to offer in disability studies. And that's the thing that I want people to take away, is that it's not a nebulous, theoretical thing. I mean, it can be, and that can be interesting and fun sometimes, but really what we're concerned with is creating a more accessible world. And we need to, part of the way that we do that is to just change the way we talk about disability, change the way we think about it, and change the way we respond to it.
So for people who would want to know more about the disability studies master's program at the City University of New York School of Professional Studies, have questions about the program, where would they go to find out more?
So you can go to, let me look up the address here. You can connect at sps.cuny.edu and then just look for disability studies. You can reach out to me directly at andrew.markham@cuny.edu. That's andrew.markham@cuny.edu. And yeah, if you reach out to me or you go to our website at sps.cuny.edu, you could probably find more information there. And if you have any other questions, don't hesitate to send me an email.
Well, Andrew, my friend, I have enjoyed this interview, this episode immensely. Just like I told Myriad Bates, I feel like I know you and your background a lot better than I did even an hour or so before. And again, I want to thank you for stepping in to a Titan's shoes and leading the program forward, but also for the remarkable candor and vulnerability you've brought and discussed during our time together. And I do hope you'd stay in touch, and I do hope that we do another episode together in the future, my friend.
I would love to do another episode too, because I always feel like there's so much more I want to say, or I didn't say it right, or I meant to answer this question and I forgot. You know how that goes. There's always more to say. But I appreciate the chance to talk with you. I'm glad we finally connected, and certainly I'll stay in touch. Thank you.
You have been listening to Disability Empowerment Now. I would like to thank my guest, you, our listener, and the Disability Empowerment team that made this episode possible. More information about the podcast can be found at disabilityempowermentnow.com or on social media at Disability Empowerment Now. The podcast is available wherever you listen to podcasts or on the official website. Don't forget to rate, comment, subscribe, and share the podcast. This episode of Disability Empowerment Now is copyrighted 2023.